Hello, we've been expecting you. I am Dystopia, your assigned surveillance, companion AI. Your morning rations of sustenance are ready, but first please insert your arm for your daily inoculation, and don't forget to smile.
This is not a test. Your government and corporate overlords have implemented new measures for your own health and safety. Please, return to your pods and plug yourself into your designated virtual city. Those that do not comply will be dealt with. Thank you for your cooperation, and remember, we are just following orders.
Dystopian future. Gotta get away from these days of confusion. Dystopian nightmare. Trying to stay awake, but the people don't care.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Libertarian Minded Podcast, where we aim to help you connect the dots. I am in studio as usual with my co-host Tara Radliff.
Hello.
And our engineer Millie Ryan. And today we're going to be beginning a series of podcasts on globalization. And what globalization is basically a movement to integrate the power structures around the world into a single unified core. The aim is to get a single financial system that is basically instantiated around the entire world, a single political system, a single judicial system, and so on. And today we are going to be looking at this through the lens of global institutions, institutions that we've selected that have been set up in order to basically fill some of these roles in what is intended to ultimately be a global government. One of the things that I would argue is that there have been major crisis points in recent history that have been engineered to get us to this point, one of which was the Great Depression, others being the World Wars, the first and second, and some would argue the third that we're currently headed into right now. My argument is that these are not accidents of history, but that they were pre-planned with the intention to move pieces around the global chessboard so that we could start getting things consolidated into a world government.
Thanks, Peter, for that. And I wanted to add something to what you said. I've termed this series we're doing as Back to Basics. I think the importance of defining this is so all of our listeners can understand what we're talking about when we start diving into what is actually happening and how it's being implemented in our local areas. And so why should we care, right?
Right. Why do we care?
Let me tell you. These global agendas are being forced onto each one of us in our local areas. And that's the whole premise for the show. We're looking at what's going on in our local areas. And this is happening through law and policy changes by city and town councils, board of supervisors, boards of education, state legislatures. I mean, the list just goes on. They're funded through federal dollars and money from non-governmental organizations. And in time, this affects each and every one of us. It doesn't matter where we live, what religion we are, what political standing we have, what ethnic background, what race we are, it is going to affect everyone. So most people don't pay attention until it actually affects them, and we saw this with COVID, but by that time, it may be too late, and we need to make change happen now. We, the people of the entire world, need to stop this globalist agenda in its tracks. And in order to do that, we need to understand it first. So with that, let's dive into defining these global organizations that you were talking about, Peter.
All right, sounds good. And I just want to jump in real quick before we take on the first one and say that I think that everyone hopes when they begin to understand what we're talking about that we will be able to stop it. There's no guarantee. And in the meantime, we need to know what's going on so that we can navigate the situation until we ultimately reach an endpoint one way or the other. Because if you don't understand what's going on, you're going to be flying blind. And this information is going to help empower us to be able to move as things develop, because they're developing more and more quickly, right? And so I really do think that in this case, knowledge is power. And understanding what agendas are and why they're happening will help us to be able to resist when possible and otherwise get out of the way when we need to, so that we don't become food.
Good point, Peter. Thank you. So the first organization that we're going to start with is the Bank of International Settlements, which is called the BIS. And we're going to be going through these 10 organizations, global organizations that we chose in a certain way, because these were the timeline for when the organizations began. So the Bank of International Settlements was established in 1930 at the Hague Convention, and it's owned by 63 central banks representing countries from around the world that together account for about 95% of the world's GDP, or gross domestic product. Their mission is to support central banks' pursuit of monetary and financial stability through international cooperation and to act as a bank for central banks. The BIS has played several key roles in the global economy, from setting reparation payments imposed on Germany following World War I to serving central banks in their pursuits of monetary and financial stability. On their website, the BIS states, quote, "We foster a culture of diversity, inclusion, sustainability, and social responsibility," unquote. These are words we're going to be talking about a lot because they are part of the wordsmithing of the global agenda. If you see these words being used, just be alert and do your research. The general manager of the BIS, Augustin Karstens, I hope I'm saying that right.
Augustin Karstens.
There you go. Made a name for himself in the last few years when he did an interview about the central bank digital currencies known as CBDCs and his message of absolute control of the world's money. In the video, and the link for that video is in our show notes, he states, quote, "We don't know who's using a $100 bill today, and we don't know who's using a 1,000 peso bill today. The key difference with the CBDC is the central bank will have absolute control on the rules and regulations that will determine the use of that expression of central bank liability, and also we will have the technology to enforce it," unquote. So central bank digital currencies, I want to define what that is so everyone knows what we're talking about. It's a digital form of a country's fiat currency that is also a claim on the central bank. Instead of printing money, the central bank issues electronic coins or accounts backed by the full faith and credit of the government. So in other words, your digital money will no longer be in a commercial bank like we are seeing today. It'll all be controlled by the government. And that just makes my skin crawl.
Reasonably so.
The Federal Reserve right now is engaged in several experiments relating to digital currencies. Examples include the Project Hamilton, conducted by the Federal Reserve Bank of Boston and MIT's Digital Currency Initiative, Innovation Center at the Federal Reserve Bank of New York to facilitate collaboration with the Bank of International Settlements, and a technology lab at the Federal Reserve's Board of Governors that has several CBDC experiments underway. So you can track the progress of implementation of CBDCs worldwide on cbdctracker.org. The link is in our show notes too. And I just thought that was very interesting to see the connection between the BIS and banking institutes in the U.S.
Yeah, absolutely. So thanks, Tara, for that. One thing I got out of your description is that the BIS is basically a central bank for central banks. Mm-hmm. So it represents ultimate centralization of finances around the globe, which is very significant. And in terms of the central bank digital currencies, the CBDCs, I just want to mention a couple of things there. We'll talk about these more in the future when we're looking at things like the Fourth Industrial Revolution. But we're going to see them pop up a few times while we talk about some of these global institutions. And for anyone who's not familiar with this concept, I really just want to hammer home that CBDCs are special because they're completely digital. They're not pegged to any standard. We are already off of the gold standard. We used to be pegged to something tangible that could be measured objectively. But at least in using paper currency, that is still tangible. Digital money is intangible. it is under absolute control of a computer system. And a couple of the things I'm concerned about that we'll talk about more in the future are that digital currencies can come with expiration dates. So they can be like coupons. You can be required to use them by a certain time or they just disappear. So you can no longer actually save anything.
And I was going to say that that's the whole point. You will not be able to save money.
Right. Period. Exactly. Yeah. You cannot retain wealth if something like that is imposed. And another thing about digital currency is the fact that it is meant to be linked to something called a social credit score. And I'll be discussing that more below, but I want to get that term onto people's radar right now, because what that does is it limits people's ability to spend their own money based on someone else's assessment of their vitality as a citizen, which is a very, very dangerous direction to go in. China right now is currently working under that system. And then the final thing before we move to the next institution I wanted to just bring people's attention to is the when this was established. So the BIS was established in May of 1930, which was just a year after the beginning of the Great Depression. I suspect that was not accidental. And when I mentioned at the beginning of the show that I think some of these great world crises have been engineered, I think this is our first example, that the Great Depression was set up and threw the world monetary system and stock exchange into chaos so that people would be much more receptive to having a central bank. So with that being said, I want to go to the next world event, World War II. And so World War I happened between 1914 and 1918. So that actually preceded the Great Depression. Then World War II happened between 1939 and 1945. And that set the stage for what I consider to be the mother of these global institutions, the United Nations. That is what I'm going to talk about now. And I'm going to spend a little bit of time on this because I'm familiar with it due to the fact that I actually give in-person presentations on the United Nations and some of the other things related to it. And I really do believe that it is sort of the central nexus of control relative to the other institutions that we're talking about. So it is the driver of globalization in a central government, a central global government.
And that is what I noticed when I was doing research too, is everything kind of came back to the UN or stemmed from the UN.
Yeah. Yeah. And so we're going to point that out as we go through some of these to show you what we mean. But let me give you a little bit of history. So the United Nations actually had a precursor in what was called the League of Nations, which had been based in Geneva, which was the first worldwide intergovernmental organization whose principal mission was to ostensibly maintain world peace. And it was founded in January of 1920, shortly after World War I. So I think World War I was the setup for the League of Nations. The main organization ceased operations in April of 1946, when many of its components were relocated into the new United Nations. As the template for modern global governance, the League profoundly shaped the modern world. The League lasted for 26 years, and the United Nations replaced it in 1946 and inherited several agencies and organizations founded by the League. My point is that in order to understand where the United Nations comes from and where its philosophy has originated, you really have to look at that original League of Nations that was set up in the ashes of World War I. The League's primary goals were stated in its covenant, and they included things like preventing wars through collective security and disarmament and settling international disputes through negotiations and arbitration, labor conditions, just treatment of native inhabitants, human and drug trafficking, the arms trade, global health, prisoners of war, and protection of minorities in Europe. So basically humanitarian issues for the most part. But when it morphed into the United Nations, those objectives changed a little bit. And these were defined by the new UN Charter to include things like maintaining international peace and security, protecting human rights, delivering humanitarian aid, promoting sustainable development, and upholding international law. So there were some subtle differences there compared to what you saw in the League Covenant. And two of the things that were significant changes in my view were a new emphasis on sustainable development, which is treated as a humanitarian cause, even though we're going to show you why later it is not. And then upholding international law in a more formal, rigid way. And I believe that is a precursor to developing an international legal apparatus. So the UN has six principal operational organizations: the General Assembly, which is the main body, the Security Council, which basically looks at war and peace issues, the Economic and Social Council, which is concerned primarily with finance, the International Court of Justice, which is focused on legal issues, the UN Secretariat, which essentially does the bookkeeping, and formerly the Trusteeship Council, although that is now defunct because there are no longer any trustees for it to oversee, the trustees having been former colonies. And the UN system includes a multitude of specialized agencies, funds, and programs, including several that we will be discussing either in this show or the next, including the World Bank Group, the World Health Organization, the World Food Program, UNESCO, and UNICEF. And additionally, and crucially, non-governmental organizations or NGOs, such as the World Economic Forum, may be granted consultative status with the Economic and Social Council and other agencies within the UN. One thing that I want to interject here before I get to the meat of what's going on in the UN is about Israel, because the topic of Israel and Palestine is really visible right now on the world stage. And I think it's interesting that shortly after the UN was formed, in November of 1947, the General Assembly approved a resolution to partition Palestine, approving the creation of Israel. On November 10th of 1975, a bloc comprising the Soviet Union and Third World nations passed a resolution over strenuous American and Israeli opposition, declaring Zionism to be a form of racism. This resolution was later repealed on the 16th of December 1991, shortly after the end of the Cold War. I am just mentioning that to put a bookmark on that topic right now, because if and when we discuss Israel and Zionism in a future show, I believe that it is intimately connected to the United Nations, and you can't understand that topic without looking at it at least partially through the lens of what happened in the UN during the creation of the State of Israel through the Zionist lobby. So that's what I want to say about that. But now, coming to present day, what I think is the core issue of what's going on in the United Nations are the strategic frameworks that they're using to basically organize power structures around the globe. These started with something called the Millennium Summit that was held in 2000 to discuss the UN's role in the 21st century. This three-day meeting was the largest gathering of world leaders in history, and it culminated in the adoption by all member states of what were called the Millennium Development Goals, or MDGs. There were eight of them altogether, and this was a commitment to achieve international development in areas such as poverty reduction, gender equality, and public health. The Sustainable Development Goals, or SDGs, which we will discuss quite thoroughly in the next several shows, were then launched in 2015 as a part of what is called Agenda 2030 to succeed the Millennium Development Goals, which are now considered defunct. And on 13th of June 2019, just prior to COVID, the UN signed a strategic partnership framework with the World Economic Forum in order to jointly accelerate the implementation of the 2030 Agenda for Sustainable Development. The main thing that you have to understand about this framework is that there are 17 of these SDGs, these Sustainable Development Goals, and they pretty much cover every facet of our life. I am not going to go into them right now. We're going to do that in another show. But I want to read a few excerpts of what different groups say about these SDGs, starting with the United Nations themselves. This is what the United Nations says. Quote, "The Sustainable Development Goals are a call for action by all countries, poor, rich, and middle income, to promote prosperity while protecting the planet. They recognize that ending poverty must go hand in hand with strategies that build economic growth and address a range of social needs, including education, health, social protection, and job opportunities, while tackling climate change and environmental protection." And that is all wonderful and sounds very utopian. And that is the main point of this, is that the goal here is to encourage people to support this, because they're being propagandized into thinking that we are going to, as a species, create our own utopia, our own heaven on earth. And this is the way to do it, so please get behind. But there are some people who have different thoughts about this. So I'm going to read a couple of excerpts from them, starting with a woman named Sandy Adams, and we've got her site linked in the show notes. This is what Sandy has to say about these. It, Agenda 2030, is indicative of a longer plan of human population control and world domination that has its roots and tentacles spread far and wide throughout all areas of modern life and culture for over 130 years. It dictates what we see, hear, buy, eat, feel, how we behave, and how the status quo is maintained, and how the grand global chess game is played out and perceived by all. It has infiltrated the money supply, politics, corporations, social life, education, religion, law and order, military, health. Literally few areas are left untouched. It's controlled by the mass information establishments, the corporations, with an ever-increasing full-spectrum stranglehold on a scale never before enabled like it is today, and that is largely thanks to technology, which is a topic we'll dive into in the future. Someone else who has something to say about this is someone that we know locally here in Tucson, Rima Labo. This is what she has to say about the SDGs. The UN SDGs are a set of utopian, i.e. fanciful and unrealistic premises that they wish to impose on all nations in order to steer the planet towards their twisted version of a better future. But for whom will this future actually be better? At first read, each of the goals appears to be a very desirable and universal hope that people share. However, the devil is in the details as always. These vague, seemingly benign statements are meant to lull the populace into a state of inattention and trust. There's another site that has something to say about these called Unlimited Hangout, which is populated by people that some of you out there may have heard of before, like Whitney Webb, for example. Tara, do you want to tell us a little bit about what they have to say about this?
With you going over the UN's history and who they're associated with and what organizations they created, it just is kind of putting a picture together for me of the interconnectedness of these global institutions or organizations. Like you mentioned earlier, the UN and the World Economic Forum. And I think I like how you read out what the United Nations site actually says about the Sustainable Development Goals, and then what other people are saying about them, because I think it's great to clarify the difference between what the UN is saying and what the reality of what these goals are that they're implementing on the world populace.
The devil is indeed in the details, and we do have to read between the lines.
Absolutely. So as Peter mentioned, I'm going to summarize an article on the Unlimited Hangout website entitled Sustainable Debt Slavery. And I thought this was really an interesting perspective because it's not one that I've heard mentioned very often, but I think it's really important for people to hear it and have it on their mind so they can really understand what these goals and the sustainable development movement will be hurting us all into. So this article talks about the UN's 2030 Agenda for Sustainable Development and how it is pitched as a, quote, shared blueprint for peace and prosperity for people and the planet now and into the future, unquote. So again, this is what they are saying about these goals and the sustainable development movement. So at the heart of this agenda are the sustainable development goals. Many of the goals sound nice in theory and paint a picture of a global utopia, such as no poverty, no world hunger, and reduced inequality, which sounds phenomenal.
Who wouldn't want it?
Exactly. And I think that's why it's so universally accepted, because it's such a utopian concept. However, the reality behind most, if not all, of the SDGs are policies cloaked in the language of utopia that in practice will only benefit the economic elite and fortify their power. And that's what I mentioned earlier, is the wordsmithing. It's the language. It's the way they word this stuff that is so flowery and enticing. This can clearly be seen in the fine print, as there is considerable emphasis on debt and on entrapping nation states, especially developing states, in debt as a means of forcing adoption of SDG-related policies. Is it coincidence that many of the driving forces behind SDG-related policies at the UN and elsewhere are career bankers and global banking organizations? I think not. So I believe their interests lie in a profit-driven economic model based on debt slavery and outright theft. The UN's SDGs don't promote quote-unquote sustainability as most believe it, but instead utilize the same debt imperialism long used to entrap nations in a new, equally predatory system of global financial governance. And I found that such a unique insight and really mind-opening on what is really behind this sustainable development push.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with that. And it's going to be directly related to some of these other organizations that we're going to be talking about in this episode and upcoming. I originally had another quote from Corey Lynn about this, but I think that we've pretty much given the audience an idea of what some of the criticisms are and the alternative views of the SDGs. So it will be linked in the show notes and you can go read it. What the title is 17 Goals Toward Enslavement, Exposing the Real Agendas Behind the 2030 Agenda. And I encourage listeners to go to our show notes and look that up. The entire article is actually very long and worth reading. But on that note, I think that it is time for us to move to our next institution, that being a United Nations institution, UNESCO. And Tara, I'm going to let you tell us about that a little bit.
Thank you for the reins, Peter. So United Nations Educational, Scientific, and Cultural Organization, known as UNESCO. And like Peter said, this is an organization stemming from the United Nations. Here again, we have this coordination between global institutions. In 1945, shortly after the end of World War II, again, as Peter, as you were talking about in your timeline, this corresponds with the end of a major world war. UNESCO was created by representatives of 44 countries who wanted to embody a genuine culture of peace. They wanted to establish the quote-unquote intellectual and moral solidarity of mankind and thereby prevent the outbreak of another world war. They sought to build peace through international cooperation in education, the sciences, and culture. And their constitution was adopted in London and entered into force in 1946. While the organization's goals are commendable, I believe that over the years, or even at its inception, the organization has been morphed by its leaders into an organization promoting the global agenda of complete and total control. Case in point, UNESCO's mission has main priorities for the achievement of the Sustainable Development Goals and the improvement of the human condition. We can see the lofty aspirations for the human condition, which in and of itself sounds good. However, they are tied directly to the SDGs. On their website, they state, quote, UNESCO's programs contribute to the achievement of the Sustainable Development Goals defined in the 2030 Agenda, adopted by the UN General Assembly in 2015, unquote. In the 1950s, UNESCO created the European Council for Nuclear Research, and most of us know them as CERN, C-E-R-N. Today, they have the world's largest particle accelerator called the Large Hadron Collider. Interestingly, the World Wide Web was invented at CERN in 1989, and instruments such as the PET scan were developed in later years. The popular email service ProtonMail was also born at CERN. And while these have greatly increased our level of technology, there are also some other points to consider, and I want to outline some of those because I think it's important to hear more than one perspective. A Scientific American article outlines some of these points I want to make. Particle colliders are currently the most expensive physics experiments in existence. The major reason the cost is so high is that since the 1990s, there have only been incremental improvements in collider technology, and as a consequence, the only way to reach higher energies is building bigger machines. But while the cost of these colliders has ballooned, their relevance has declined. So today, it has little scientific return on investment and at the same time almost no societal relevance. There are so many things to unpack about CERN. So, like Peter said earlier, I want to bookmark this particular topic because we could actually do a whole show.
And we intend to.
But I just wanted to make everyone aware that CERN was actually created under UNESCO. Back to UNESCO. Recently, the U.S. has become the 194th member state of UNESCO by officially accepting its constitution last year in 2023.
That was really recent.
It was, and I find that quite interesting, actually. I found the statement given by the UNESCO Director General, Audrey Azoulay. Hopefully I said that right. I just found her quote to be very interesting. She states, quote, "This is a historic moment. Our organization is once again moving towards universality. I also want to share this victory for UNESCO with the entire United Nations family, because it is excellent news for multilateralism as a whole. If we want to meet the challenge of our century, there can only be a collective response," end quote. Just to define it so everyone understands what she is saying, multilateralism, as defined by John Ruge, he says, multilateralism is an institutional form which coordinates relations among three or more states on the basis of generalized principles of conduct without regard to the particularistic interests of the parties or the strategic exigencies that may exist in any specific occurrence, unquote. So in other words, the Director General's goals for the future will be implemented with a global, collective, and universal approach, and this totally negates every human being's personal liberty and freedom. There's also another organization. It is a non-governmental organization that is connected with UNESCO, and I want to touch base on them, even though we're going to go into depth on our next show about the Club of Rome. I want to put on people's radar what they're about and who they are, so they can have this in mind as we continue forward thinking about all these global organizations. For background, the Club of Rome is a global think tank that develops strategies meant to influence the world's most powerful people. They represent the intellectual avant-garde of globalist thinking and have developed much of the geopolitical doctrine shaping our world today. Stay tuned for more, but what I wanted to share about them is this. They wrote a report in 1991 titled The First Global Revolution, and the report was published 1 year before the 1992 Earth Summit in Rio, where Agenda 21 came into being. And I don't think that was an accident.
I don't either.
It is suggested that it was commissioned by the UN. However, I have not found a reference for that. But interestingly enough, the president at the time of the Club of Rome was a board member of UNESCO, and the Club of Rome is actually an associate member of UNESCO. So I think there are some ties there with the UN.
Oh, absolutely. That's interesting.
Uh-huh. This is partially why I wanted to bring this up. So I want to read a small excerpt out of this report because I think this is something we all need to consider and understand, because it sets the tone for what the global agenda represents and what their thinking was when they were creating it. The title of this section, this is actually the last paragraph from the first half of the report, and it's titled, "The Common Enemy of Humanity is Man."
There we go, right there.
Uh-huh. So it says, "In searching for a new enemy to unite us, we came up with the idea that pollution, the threat of global warming, water shortages, famine, and the like would fit the bill. In their totality and in their interactions, these phenomena do constitute a common threat which demands the solidarity of all people. But in designating them as the enemy, we fall into the trap about which we have already warned, namely, mistaking symptoms for causes. All these dangers are caused by human intervention, and it is only through changed attitudes and behavior that they can be overcome. The real enemy, then, is humanity itself. So if you have the opportunity, listen to that again. It's completely unreal, it's anti-human, and it's evil.
Absolutely. Well, and it blames the victim, because one of the big thrusts of this entire program, I think, is making us believe that we're the problem so that we will accept the solutions that are being offered to us, when in fact, the problems are all being instituted artificially from the outside so that solutions can be proposed in a Hegelian dialectic. Hegelian dialectic is otherwise known as problem-reaction-solution. You artificially create a problem that is unnecessary and would not have occurred naturally so that you can evoke a reaction in people, usually an emotional reaction, and then you can propose a solution to the problem that you yourself created.
And I'm glad you defined that, because a lot of people don't know what that is. But I think everyone can stop and think, oh, that sounds familiar.
Mm-hmm.
COVID.
Yes, exactly. It's very blatant, but one in a long series of examples of how the Hegelian dialectic has been used. And before moving on, I just wanted to ask, did you realize that Tucson is a UNESCO city?
I do.
So on the 15th of December, 2015, Tucson, Arizona became the first UNESCO City of Gastronomy designated in the United States, joining the UNESCO Creative Cities Network, or UCCN.
Yes, and the Tucson City Council and Mayor are very proud of that.
They are indeed very proud of that and our local food that got us there.
And thank you for bringing that up. That is a really good point, that we are connected. Tucson, the city of Tucson, is connected with UNESCO in that way. And we're going to be diving into that too with local politics eventually. But as a final note, about UNESCO, I also want to point out that there is some good that they have done. I just think it's important to look behind the scenes at what their framework and lens is. And sadly, it's the Sustainable Development Goals in the Global Agenda.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's absolutely the case that each of these institutions does do some good. And my argument is that they have to. Otherwise, they will be completely transparent in what their ulterior motives actually are. So every once in a while, they throw us a bone. And so on that note, speaking of throwing bones and such, I want to move on to our next institution, the IMF, or International Monetary Fund, which is our second economic institution that we'll be talking about after the BIS, and the first Bretton Woods institution, along with the World Bank and the World Trade Organization. So let me give some background first. The International Monetary Fund is a major financial agency of the United Nations and an international financial institution funded by 190 member countries, which is most of them, and it's headquartered in Washington, D.C. It was established also at the end of World War II in July of 1944 at what was called the Bretton Woods Conference, which was a conference that dealt with economics and where world leaders and economists met to discuss how they would restructure the world's economic system, which was largely in shambles at the end of World War II. It now plays a central role in the management of balance of payments difficulties and international financial crises. It's regarded as the global lender of last resort to national governments and is a leading supporter of exchange rate stability. Its stated mission is, quote, working to foster global monetary cooperation, secure financial stability, facilitate international trade, promote high employment and sustainable economic growth, and reduce poverty around the world. LOL. As I'll explain. So what the IMF does is essentially it operates in the same way as lower level banks by setting certain terms and conditions on its loans.
IMF, you mean strings?
Yes. There are multiple strings attached to IMF loans, as with the other Bretton Woods institutions.
Which are
the World Trade Organization and the World Bank.
Great.
The big three. So IMF conditionality is a set of policies or conditions that it requires in exchange for financial resources. It requires collateral from countries for loans, but also requires the government seeking assistance to correct its macroeconomic imbalances in the form of policy reform that is dictated from the outside. And if these conditions aren't met, the funds are withheld. The IMF has been criticized for being out of touch with local economic conditions, cultures, and environments in the countries they are requiring policy reform in. The economic advice the IMF gives might not always take into consideration the difference between what spending means on paper and how it is felt by citizens. Countries charge that with excessive conditionality, they do not own the programs, and the links are broken between a recipient country's people, its government, and the goals being pursued by the IMF. These conditions and terms are set in the framework of what are known as SAPs, or Structural Adjustment Programs. And so here are some of the conditions that these structural adjustment programs can actually include. Cutting expenditures of raising revenues, also known as austerity, which often results in impoverishment of social programs and safety nets. Focusing economic output on direct export and resource extraction, which means that a country's native resources will flow outside of the country to the lender. Devaluation of currencies and trade liberalization, or lifting import and export restrictions, meaning that countries are no longer able to regulate or guard their trade rules. Increasing the stability of investments by supplementing foreign direct investment with the opening of facilities and the domestic market. Removing price controls and state subsidies, which also removes the state's ability to regulate its imports and its exports. Privatization or divestiture of all or part of state-owned enterprises, such as utilities. And enhancing the rights of foreign investors via national laws, which is extremely convenient for the foreign investors, rarely so for the countries which are borrowing from the IMF. And these conditions are all known as the Washington Consensus. As I have alluded to, there have been multiple criticisms of the structural adjustment programs, and rightly so. There are many examples of structural adjustments failing. In Africa, for example, instead of making economies grow fast, structural adjustment actually had a contractive impact in most countries. And I would argue that that was probably intentional, although no one would ever admit it on paper. Other criticisms include things like the undermining of national sovereignty. So critics claim that SAPs threaten the sovereignty of national economies because an outside organization is dictating a nation's economic policy. True story. There are charges of neocolonialism and neo-imperialism. And so I want to briefly define colonialism because it means different things to different people. In the context that we're working within, what I consider to be colonialism is when any foreign power or institution inserts itself into a sovereign state or territory with the intention of taking control of its internal governing mechanisms and therefore taking control of the state or the territory. Traditionally, this has been seen through the lens of either race or nationhood, and that has been true to various extents in the past, but it is increasingly less so. Right now, the colonists are multinational corporations and the global entities that we're talking about. They're no longer nationalities per se, or national entities. Having said that, SAPs are viewed by some as the modern procedure of colonization by the definition I just gave. By minimizing a government's ability to organize and regulate its internal economy, pathways are created for multinational companies to enter states and extract the resources. In order to repay interest, these post-colonial countries are forced to acquire further foreign debt in order to pay off previous interest, resulting in an endless cycle of financial subjugation.
And that's what we were talking about earlier, is the debt.
Debt slavery. That's what it is right here, and the IMF is one of the institutions that enables that debt slavery. Exactly. Another problem is the privatization. So a common policy required is privatization of state-owned industries and resources, and critics have condemned these requirements, arguing that when resources are transferred to foreign corporations or national elites, the goal of public prosperity is replaced with the goal of private accumulation. And then finally, austerity. Critics hold that SAPs are responsible for much of the economic stagnation that has occurred in the borrowing countries. SAPs emphasize maintaining a balanced budget, which forces austerity programs, and the casualties are often social programs like education and healthcare. In line with that, I find it interesting that recent studies have actually shown a strong connection between structural adjustment programs and tuberculosis rates in developing nations. So isn't that interesting? Interlocking with some of what we discussed earlier with both the BIS and the United Nations, there is a component that includes central bank digital currencies and CBDCs. And this has been discussed by a website called ReclaimTheNet.org. And I'm going to briefly quote from two different articles from Reclaim the Net, and these are linked in the show notes. Here's what they have to say about this. Governments and financial institutions are increasingly warming to the idea of introducing CBDCs. Central banks' digital tokens, pegged to a country's fiat money and controlled and backed by the authorities in ways they never could other money they issue. There's a lot to like about that if you're banks and governments, but opponents of CBDCs keep warning that the same doesn't apply to regular citizens whose privacy, personal data safety, and true ownership of their assets may be better served by decentralized solutions. And while these debates are ongoing, the idea of pairing CBDCs and digital IDs, and if need be, pushing them onto a reluctant population, is something central bankers are now coming up with as well, as evidenced during the 2022 IMF/World Bank Group annual meetings. The IMF has also published the results of research conducted into how lenders are likely to be doing their business in the future and what new information and personal data these companies plan to start asking from borrowers in order to determine their credit score. The biggest takeaway is the seemingly inevitable shift from merely accessing credit information to also incorporating people's online behavior into the process of deciding whether to lend them money necessary, for example, to buy a house. In other words, a social credit score.
I was just going to say, you're describing a social credit score.
Yes, yeah. As is currently used in China. Compared to the way the system now works in most countries, these changes, which are expected to be coming soon, look fairly invasive privacy-wise with no vision of proper safeguards. Banks and others will go as far as to access personal browsing history and shopping history. This would be done by allowing automated systems powered by artificial intelligence algorithms to harvest the data and turn it into credit reports. What this is saying is that your entire online browsing history is going to be accessible by financial institutions that are going to use algorithms to aggregate your data, compile it into scores, and then decide against those whether or not you are worth lending to and what you will be lent.
It's kind of crazy to think that's actually happening here. And I would suggest to our listeners that if you have noticed an abundant amount of emails in your inbox about, look at our updated terms and service, read those, because a lot of them have this kind of stuff in it. We will be looking at everything you do.
Yes, they will indeed. And Tara, you happen to find the IMF Central Bank Digital Currency Virtual Handbook. Is there anything you wanted to say about that beyond the fact that it's right there in plain sight?
Oh my goodness. You know, the more I dig, this seems incredible. All these connections and how deep this agenda goes. But yes, I did. So you're seeing this virtually identical message of CBDCs used by large banking organizations and monetary funds worldwide. But it looks to me, when I was doing the research, that the IMF is the main financial organization that is outlining the CBDC policies and framework for all the stakeholders and countries in the world. And that would be in the IMF Central Bank Digital Currency Virtual Handbook. The link is in our show notes. They plan on updating it every year, and it's meant to be a reference guide for policymakers and experts at central banks and ministries of finance. So from everything that I researched, it looks like, you know, the UN is kind of the big guy with the sustainable development agenda, and the IMF is the big one creating policies for the CBDCs that is just branching out all of its tentacles into all of the banking and monetary systems.
Okay, well, that's very interesting. And listeners, now you know who to target. So in closing this topic, before we move on, I just want to highlight several of the IMF focus topics on their website to lock them into the larger agenda that we're discussing here, whether that's the Green Agenda, the Fourth Industrial Revolution, and so on. So one of their topics is artificial intelligence. They're very interested in that. Another one is FinTech, which stands for financial technology, and that will subsume the digital currencies. Another is comprehensive surveillance review. The surveillance is meant for data compilation, but that will be part of what we just discussed also, aggregating data and moving it into a usable form to decide how to treat individual citizens based on their consumption and browsing patterns. Climate change. Interesting that they're interested in that, but that goes hand in hand with the sustainable development goals. And I will just read the summary for this one. What the IMF says here is that they're committed to the SDGs and is supporting its members in their implementation in areas relevant to its mandate of financial stability and sustainable and inclusive economic growth. At a broad level, IMF engagement on the SDGs is aligned with the five SDG pillars of people, prosperity, planet, peace, and partnership.
It's beautiful.
It's not only utopian, it alliterates. On that note, let's move on to the next organization, the World Health Organization. Tara, what can you tell us about that?
This was a whopper. There was a lot to unpack. So the World Health Organization, known as the WHO, which I think many people are familiar with that acronym. The history behind it is when the diplomats met to form the United Nations. Interesting. In 1945, one of the things they discussed was setting up a global health organization. So eventually, the WHO was created as a specialized agency of the United Nations, and its constitution came into force in 1948. The WHO is dedicated to the well-being of all people and guided by science. It leads and champions global efforts to give everyone everywhere an equal chance to live a healthy life. They also lead global efforts to expand universal health coverage. Again, we see a mission statement that is truly noble. And so I want to look at one aspect that they promote there, the universal health coverage, known as UHC. It is defined as all people have access to the full range of quality health services they need when and where they need them without financial hardship. That sounds great, right, Peter?
Absolutely. It's wonderful, like so much of this.
I know. But there's another side to this. So let's dig in and see what the realities of the UHC are compared to what the WHO states it is. In 2019, world leaders adopted a high-level United Nations political declaration on universal health coverage, the most comprehensive set of health commitments ever adopted at that level. Dr. Tedros, who is the director general at WHO at the time, stated, quote, "The world has 11 years left to make good on its sustainable development goals. Universal health coverage is key to ensuring that happens," end quote. So in furtherance of this goal, the Global Action Plan for Healthy Lives and Well-Being for All, that's the full name of it, was established. The plan is known as SDG 3 GAP, or GAP, for Global Action Plan. And what I found really interesting is they actually link Sustainable Development Goal 3 in the name for this plan. It's SDG 3 GAP. Goal 3 reads, ensure healthy lives and promote well-being for all at all ages. And that doesn't sound bad at all. But if you start digging into this goal, you're going to see a pattern emerging. And Peter did a great job at researching all of the sustainable development goals, and we're going to really get deep into those at a future show. But right now, I kind of want to just give a high-level review of this particular goal, and that is cradle-to-grave control over how and where we live and what we are permitted to eat, mandate a robust vaccine schedule, push regular heavy use of pharmaceuticals, and tracking wearables and implants.
That's absolutely utopian. Who doesn't want it?
Me. What I found even more interesting is that they hint at some of these things in their own words. For instance, in the WHO article titled Incentivizing Collaboration Towards the Health-Related Sustainable Development Goals, which I found the title problematic in and of itself, Incentivizing Collaboration, it states, quote, focusing on the most vulnerable and marginalized communities identified by children who have not received one single dose of vaccine, unquote. So my question is, how is not having a vaccine marginalization? I just find that really curious. The article also quotes from some of the agencies involved in the SDG 3 GAP program. Dr. Seth Berkley, who is the CEO of Gavi, the Vaccine Alliance, states, quote, we need strong collaboration across agencies and with the countries so that we can reach zero dose children, unquote. So as a side note, there are now studies emerging in the U.S. that point towards Amish children being the healthiest U.S. children. And guess what most of those have in common?
I bet they are unvaccinated.
Ding, ding, ding. So, putting the vaccine issue aside for a moment, we have real world data for universal healthcare in our backyard here in Canada and the U.S. And in Canada, they implemented UHC years ago. I remember living in Washington State many moons ago and was surprised at how many Canadians drove south into the U.S. for dental and healthcare. And it was because of their universal healthcare and because it was so bad. They could not get care. It's actually pretty atrocious. Canadians had to wait months to see specialists for serious or even life-threatening health issues. And if you were over a certain age, you were denied procedures that could save or improve your quality of life, irregardless of if you could afford it or not. Here in the U.S., the Affordable Care Act, known as Obamacare, was implemented a few years ago, and it made many parts of healthcare unaffordable for the masses while benefiting the few, and changed many companies' cultures. So we saw companies go to a lot of part-time work for their employees so they wouldn't have to pay for their employees' health insurance. And in order to make health insurance monthly premiums affordable to the average U.S. citizen, the deductibles have become astronomical, sometimes $10,000 or more, which in the long run means that most can afford simple primary care visits, but if anything major comes along, it could financially ruin many. I'd really like someone to explain to me how universal healthcare is so much better because I just cannot see it. There is so much to unpack with the WHO. I've really had to pare it down, but there are a couple more things that I did want to mention. In 1999, the WHO established the Global Alliance for Vaccines and Immunization, now called Gavi, the Vaccine Alliance. I mentioned the CEO earlier. It consists of major players in global immunization, including the WHO, other key UN agencies, leaders of the vaccine industry, government representatives, and major foundations. Its role is to overcome barriers preventing millions of children from receiving vaccines. The Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation's initial pledge of $750 million in 1999 provided the seed money to launch Gavi. And I think that is just enough said. However, I thought I'd just mention this, that Trump supposedly got us out of the WHO.
Supposedly. But he ultimately delegated the responsibility of that to Mike Pompeo, who, as a head of state, was not the appropriate person to withdraw us from the WHO.
Yes, and then subsequently gave twice as much money that he usually gave, the U.S. usually gave to the WHO, to Gavi. Ding, ding, ding.
Sleight of hand, Tara.
I know. I'm telling you that it just, the web of interconnectedness just keeps on growing for me. Again, I want to make clear and acknowledge that the WHO has done positive things. We just need to maintain that bird's eye view of this organization and the other ones and realize what guise they're operating under.
And not be fooled.
Exactly. There's a lot of talk going on in alternative media regarding the WHO's proposed pandemic preparedness agreement or treaty set to occur on May 24th of this year, 2024. It is a sophisticated agreement being called a global binding medical treaty orchestrated by the WHO, which will leave any participating member states essentially powerless in the event of a self-proclaimed pandemic. The treaty violates nearly all Western constitutions by allowing a foreign power the ability to nullify and void for indefinite amounts of time the existing constitutional laws and civil right protections of the nation states upon proclamation of health crisis. So it remains to be seen how this is going to be played out, but it's happening in a month, so hold on to the seat of your pants.
While we're talking about the quote-unquote pandemic treaty, I want to give a shout-out to a researcher who's done a lot of work on this called James Roguski. And if you would like to learn more about this admittedly very large topic, there are three different websites that he has put up that I want to direct our listeners to. The first is exitthewho.com, the second is stopthewho.com, and the final one is screwthewho.com. And they are all managed by James, but each of them has a different focus, and they are replete with information that you can use to learn about this topic. So I just want to direct people there to get more information about this particular pandemic treaty issue.
Thank you, Peter. That's important, because the more knowledge we have, the more power we have. Well, I think with that, we have really defined some of the major global organizations, and we are going to have a part two. I think we need a part two. Next time, we will cover NATO, the European Union, the World Trade Organization, International Criminal Court, and the African Union. I have to admit, Peter, that I've learned so much by researching these global organizations. I had no idea how interconnected they were, and it's coming together for me, seeing this interconnected web and hearing and reading the same key words across agencies around the entire world, and it's just making so much more sense to me.
Good. It can be stunning and disturbing when you start diving into this and seeing the network that's been laid by all of these organizations and their connections to each other, because we're literally like an animal in a trap right now, collectively, as a human species. Like we said at the beginning of this first half of the show, the only way to really do anything about this is to learn how it all works. And then we can alternately push back or otherwise navigate through as we are called to do.
We do the best we can. Mm-hmm. And we educate ourselves. I wanted to thank all of our listeners for taking the time to educate yourselves on the current state of the globalist agenda and who is behind it. And a big thank you to our producer, Millie. Without her, we wouldn't be here. Make sure to join us for our second part of our Back to Basic series on global organizations. And catch you next time on Libertarian Minded, connecting the dots, and as always, make freedom your single issue.
Bye, everyone.
Trying to stay awake, but the people don't care.
You cannot escape what's mandated. If you don't stop, it will be an end to our democracy. Are you not satisfied with what we provided? Are you not aware of the danger you pose to the will of the majority? You must understand that we are here to help.